Hello and welcome to Skeptically Yours, where thinking is free. Today's episode brought to you by the Big Bang.
Boom.
Sitting next to me is my co-host and producer, Heather Henderson.
Hi, everybody.
You know Heather from the Facebooks, from the No God Band, and from our other award-winning podcast, Ardent Atheist. You can find links to our guest's website, join our Twitter and Facebook feeds, subscribe to our premium 90-minute full-length episodes in our email at skepticallyyours.net.
If you'd like to take part in the live chat moderated by the author of the blog, Comedy Obscura, Joe Swam, go to skepticallyyours.net/live and chat us up right now.
That's exactly right. And also, please go to iTunes, subscribe to our podcast for free, write a review, help us get up there in the top 10 where you've never put us. You may also go to skepticallyyours.net/premium and subscribe to our premium ad-free content for a measly $10 per year.
Subscribe now.
That's it?
Yes.
Simple.
Yep.
Well done.
Or I'll rip ya.
Nice.
If you're a listener who's ever been duped by anything that's been debunked on Snopes, welcome. Your ordeal is over.
We're coming to you live from the amazing meeting at Las Vegas, Nevada. In the podcast studio suite tonight, we have Geechee Guy, Matt Black, and Simon Singh. You know these guys.
From the world of reason.
It's the dumbest thing we do.
And showbiz.
I fear it's not the dumbest thing we do.
No, it's
not today. It
won't
be.
Not today. Every time I work with Geechee Guy, it gets dumb.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we're sitting here with one of the smartest guys in the room, in the world,
Thank you very much.
No.
Oh.
What the hell's wrong with you, man?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's the guy darker with skin guy.
I'm not talking
proud
about
to say.
The guy with the Amish beard.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Geechee Guy. I've worked for years with Geechee Guy. These guys are both comics. And
we had the same joke. That's how we knew each other. We
wrote the same concept.
Same joke separately and did it separately on different parts of the country.
Yeah, and, the stop.
Flashing
light.
Red light.
Flashing
yeah.
red light.
A sign that said no turn on red, but it was a flashing red light, and we had to time it.
Yeah, took a long time.
Yeah.
Very, very short spurts of driving. So, Simon, thanks for doing my show.
My pleasure.
It's absolutely a joy to have you
Where
on.
Where are you from?
Well, my family a long, long time ago came from India. About 1935, my grandfather went to England. And then I was born in England and grew up in England, and that's my home.
Yeah. And what are you doing here?
Well, I'm here at the amazing meeting. I mean, what I love most of all is science.
Yes.
So I love physics and maths. And then...
Maths.
We don't call it that here in the
because
US
we're idiots.
Of A.
It isn't one thing.
We don't do maths here. So.
There's a whole just video on a channel called Number File,
yep.
which I hate to admit.
And you're on?
I'm on it, but a few other people are on it, and there's a lovely video which kind of explains that you guys have got it right on the math thing.
I disagree. I'll tell you, after living with Matt Kirshen for a while, I was convinced that we have it wrong.
Yeah.
And then I watched that. I saw the Number File episode you're talking about, and I'm like, bullshit. No, it's multiple disciplines. It's not one discipline. What was their argument? You don't remember either,
no,
do you?
I don't remember.
You know why? Because it was shitty.
Exactly. math is short for mathematics.
Exactly.
So it's still plural.
That's my argument right there.
Oh.
I'm saying the goobers got it wrong. Now I got to go back and watch that episode. You're going to watch it too, aren't you?
It's mathematics. Short for mathematics.
That's right. Mathematics. For
uh-huh.
one. It also represents multiple disciplines. It's not just one thing. Maths are applied in different ways. That's true, right, Simon?
Yeah. I'm just trying to think of counterexamples. I'm just trying to think of what was in the video that won my heart.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So you were convinced when you saw it.
Yeah.
I would have to be pushed your way because you're smarter. I always lean with the smart
guy. He's wearing the glasses.
I think it's just semantic.
Semantic.
Yeah.
I see what you did.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, I saw it. I'm right over here.
Okay.
Well done, Geechee.
So what's your specialty? What do you specialize in?
So I did a degree in physics, and then I did a PhD in particle physics. So I was at CERN for a few years.
He is smart.
Oh, he's crazy smart. His books?
And then I went into I worked for the BBC for about 6 years. I made TV shows, and then I went into writing books. And
So, as I said,
I love science, and I love celebrating science and seeing how great maths and science are. But then I got to a point where I realized, as well as celebrating good science, it's important to challenge the bad science.
Yes.
Which is where I suppose the skepticism angle comes in, and which is why I'm here in Vegas.
In promotion of good science, the Simpsons book, The Simpsons and their Mathematical Secrets. I had no idea. You came on my television and told me this.
Yeah, well, it's there are loads of books about The Simpsons. You know, the theology of The Simpsons, The Gospel According to Bart, the sociology of The Simpsons, the philosophy of The Simpsons, because, you know, with a show that's run for 500 episodes, you can find anything you want to talk about. But when I read about the mathematics of The Simpsons, I think people thought, oh, yeah, Simon's obviously struggling to kind of pull out every bit of math. But what people don't realize is the writers of the show, a lot of them, are mathematicians. You know, David X. Cohen has written papers in mathematics. You know, Mike Reese was a mathematician.
Schwarzwelder is really
Well into numbers and probability. There's Jeff Westbrook was a professor at Yale. Ken Keeler has a PhD in applied math. J. Stuart Burns was doing a PhD at Berkeley before he quit to become a comedy writer. So these people, they're not mathematicians now, but they love mathematics. And the way they express that ongoing love is by putting equations and formulae and numbers into the show. Right. And unless you know where to look, it just flies straight by.
Yeah, so, it's loaded with Easter eggs.
Yeah.
Do they do it in... They have to be doing it in Futurama or have done it in Futurama, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I thought you got into that some,
though. Yeah, no. So the last three or four chapters of the book are about Futurama.
Got it.
Which is nice, because a lot of the mathematics in Futurama is more about geometry. There's one episode, for example, 2D Blacktop, I think, where the professor and Leela are having a race on a drag strip, but it's not an ordinary drag strip. It's a Möbius drag strip. Okay, so a Möbius strip is one of these weird objects which only has one surface.
Yeah.
So we look at this table; it's got a top and a bottom. We look at a wall; it's got a back and a front. Möbius strip doesn't have two sides; it's only got one side. Interesting bit of maths. And then Leela and the professor have a head-on collision, and they get squashed into two dimensions.
I saw that episode.
It's a beautiful episode. Fun. And you then have a whole exploration, a scene which explores the mathematics of two dimensions, which is an homage to a book by Edwin A. Abbott called Flatland. And so you have maths of Möbius strip, maths of two dimensions, and then in order to get back to three dimensions, instead of just kind of snapping their fingers and popping back into a third dimension, they go through intermediate fractional dimensions. Mm. They go through a fractal landscape, and fractals have fractional dimensionality. And you have this beautiful fractal animation, which, if you don't know what it is, it just looks beautiful. But if you know what it is, wow, it's more maths.
Right, works
so,
on multiple
as you say,
layers.
Futurama, you know, just is just as mathematical, if not more so, than The Simpsons.
Yeah, I was sitting in a Starbucks not too long ago. It was about a year or two ago, and one of the final episodes of final season, one of the episodes. A friend of mine writes for the show, and he came in, and I said, "Hey, what's up?" And he sat down, plopped in a chair, and he was just like spent. And I go, "What's going on?" He goes, "I'm trying to figure out how to make this manifold time machine thing work on Futurama." And I grab my computer. I go, "Let's talk." And so we sat there for an hour, looking up facts, looking up information to roll in. And it's not just joke writing; it is real scientific. Discovery and understanding and ideas being communicated through humor. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, I heard David S. Cohen interviewed recently on a British radio show called The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, comedy always has to come first. It's a comedy show, and that comes number one.
Right.
But if you can get the science right, then that's really what they love to do as well.
Right.
And I didn't really look at the science because you kind of expect to find science in science fiction.
Yeah.
I focused on the maths because, you know, you don't expect to find... there's one episode, The Prisoner of Bender, where the Professor Farnsworth invents a mind-switching machine where we can switch minds and bodies and so on. And everybody starts switching minds and bodies, and it gets to a point in the episode where people want to get back to their original bodies. But the problem is that the machine, once it's switched two people, we cannot switch back. So if we're going to switch back, we're going to have to switch through third parties.
They created what they created was a Rubik's cube of personalities and bodies.
And when you switch one bit of the Rubik's cube, are you going to mess it up somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
And so Ken Keeler went home that evening and tried to work out what would be required to guarantee that everybody would be able to get back to their original bodies.
Right.
And he proved mathematically that if you introduce two fresh bodies into the room, Those fresh bodies give you enough wiggle room for everybody else to get back to their original bodies, and the two fresh bodies also end up back in their original bodies. And that's called the Futurama theorem, or Keeler's theorem. It's a real bit of mathematics.
That came out of writing a goddamn joke show.
Right. And it's the only comedy show in history where the writers have developed their own mathematical theorem purely to resolve a plot point.
Right.
This is how extraordinary the show was.
Matt's brain has just exploded.
Yes, it has.
Well, all right, so... I don't know if you can make us understand this. Matt Kirshen one evening was trying to help me understand, and it was really, really tough, because I think it takes a special mind. Now, I'm talking about Fermat's Last Theorem. Am I saying the name right?
Yeah, absolutely.
How can you make an idiot like me wrap his brain around this?
Us, like us.
Me too.
I don't want to speak for these idiots.
Please speak.
That would be rude.
I mean, the beautiful thing about it is it's a bit like what some people call a blue sky problem. Well, a blue sky problem can mean something else. But in this context, I mean, a blue sky question is one that we can all look up at the sky and say, why is the sky blue?
Yeah.
It's a childish kind of question.
Mm-hmm.
Answering why the sky is blue actually requires a lot of physics.
Yeah.
And so it's a simple question to ask, but a difficult question to answer. And Fermat's Last Theorem is exactly like that. The question is quite easy. And the question dates back to a French guy called Pierre de Fermat about 350 years ago. He was a French judge just outside Toulouse. I went to his house, actually, earlier this year for the first time. And as a judge, you weren't supposed to socialize with other people in the town because... you might then look biased if they ended up in front of you. So each evening he would retire to his home and he would do mathematics. That was his hobby. And he read an ancient Greek text called the Arithmetica by a Greek mathematician called Diophantus of Alexandria.
Okay.
So it's this big, beautiful book in Latin and Greek. And he would read these problems set by Diophantus. And one of them said, find a square number added to a square number that equals a square number. Okay, which is
simple question.
Simple question. Like 2 squared plus 3 squared, 4 and 9 is 13. That's not a square number. That doesn't work. But 3 squared plus 4 squared, 9 and 16 is 25. That's 5 squared. Bang, you've got an answer.
Right.
So a square plus a square makes another square. There are actually an infinite number of solutions. And so Fermat knew that. It was an easy question. So he changed the question. Instead of a square plus a square equaling a square, he said, what about a cube plus a cube equaling another cube?
Okay.
What about a fourth power plus a fourth power equaling a fourth power? Or a hundredth power plus a hundredth power equaling a hundredth power?
Yeah.
Can you find any numbers to fit those equations?
Yeah.
And people, he looked at this page, he looked at this formula, he tried different numbers, he plugged them in. Whatever he put into this equation, no numbers made the equation balance.
Couldn't find it.
And then he went even further.
And that's a golden ring for mathematicians, right? To find an unsolvable question. Isn't that right?
Well, he just thought this was interesting because the first equation we talked about, that's one equation with an infinite number of solutions.
Yeah.
Fermat's now come up with an infinite number of equations which don't seem to have any solutions.
Right.
And he then said that he could prove it. He said he had a logical, watertight, absolute mathematical argument that demonstrated why you would never find any numbers that fitted these equations.
Okay.
And he wrote in the margin of his book, he wrote, I have a marvelous proof, a demonstrationem mirabilum, he wrote in Latin.
It was crushed by an anvil?
It was even lazier than that. He just said, but I don't have the space to write it down.
No, he didn't.
He didn't.
What do you think really happened there?
He did this a lot because he died a few years later and people found the book, and the book was full of this kind of, I can prove this, but I got to go and wash my hair. I can prove this, but I got to go and feed the dog. You know, he used to do this all the time, and it was really frustrating.
Yeah.
And mathematicians had to go through that book one by one, page by page, finding the proofs. And it turned out whenever Fermat said he had a proof, they found the proof, except in this case. And that's why it's known as Fermat's Last Theorem, because it's the last one anyone could ever find Fermat's proof for.
And has it been found?
Yeah, it took 350 years. People tried, they failed. The more they failed, the more people wanted to prove it. There were heroes and villains. There were $1 million prizes offered for this proof. and eventually a 10-year-old kid
watching Futurama.
Watching Futurama. he just said, as I said earlier, a 10-year-old kid can kind of understand this problem.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to solve it. And he obviously couldn't. He went through high school, he couldn't do it. He went to college, he couldn't do it. He went to grad school, he couldn't do it. He became a professor, he couldn't do it. And eventually, around the age of 40, after working for 7 years in complete secrecy, he locked himself away. He found the proof. He built this immense architecture, 200 pages of pure mathematics.
Wow.
And he proved it. And it's a story about mathematics, but it's a story about childhood ambition, about obsession, about the beauty of mathematics.
About never getting laid.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
He had a family. You know, he was married. He had two kids. And nobody suspected that he was secretly working on this problem, because if he told the world he was proving Fermat's Last Theorem, they'd have laughed at him. They'd have said,
right,
this problem's 350 years old. Why do you think you're so clever?
Yeah, is one of the things. You just show up with the answer, or you'd shut your mouth until you have it.
Yeah, and what he'd done was he had a whole stack of maths that he hadn't published previously.
Yeah.
And so every 6 months he'd publish this a random paper that he'd been working on previously. So everybody thought he was working on this other stuff, whereas actually he was dedicating himself to the most notorious problem in the history of mathematics.
Wow.
It's the first time I've heard about a mathematician being closeted. It's kind of interesting. He was until he was out. You're listening to Skeptically Yours and SkepticallyYours.net and available to the iTunes Store. More after this unavoidable irritation. I think this is very appropriate.
Good news, everyone.
That's right. Good news indeed. We have a premium ad-free service. We do the show for 90 minutes, and you'll be able to listen to the live show and or download the first hour for free from iTunes. The premium service, however, will allow you to subscribe to the full 90-minute ad-free show. It's only $10 per year. If you want to support us, please go to skepticallyyours.net/premium and subscribe. And now, before our break, as we often do a joke, I'm not doing a joke. Geechee Guy will do the joke.
Okay. A husband goes up to his wife and says, how about a quickie? And she says, as opposed to what?
Foundation Beyond Belief is a community of compassionate humanists and atheists supporting outstanding charities worldwide. Members sign up for automatic donations starting at $5 a month, then distribute those funds however they wish among the featured charities. To date, this unique humanist organization has raised over $750,000 to make this world a better, more humane place. We don't look to the skies for a better world. Foundation Beyond Belief is humanity at work. Learn more or join us at foundationbeyondbelief.org.
Hi, I'm David Diskin, and I wanted to tell you about Camp Quest West. We're a secular summer camp for non-religious families, and our week-long program for kids runs this summer in locations in California and over a dozen others throughout the U.S. At Camp Quest, we give kids the traditional camp experience like archery, swimming, arts and crafts, and campfire songs, but we add science, skepticism, humanism, and critical thinking. There's a few spots left for parents who want to register their kids, but we're also asking for your help. We turn every donation into camperships for families that can't afford to send their children to camp. We're 100% volunteer-based, a tax-exempt 501c3, and our amazing financial aid program is supported by the free thought and skeptic community by people like you. I want to see how much Emery and Heather's fans can raise for Camp Quest West. Visit tinyurl.com/ardentcampquest or look for the link on their Facebook page. You can learn more about our California camps and the others throughout the U.S. by visiting campquest.org.
Hey, kids, remember the good old days of simple, wholesome fun? Back when you could watch cartoons on Saturday morning? Remember watching Mr. Peabody and Sherman use their Wayback Machine to visit the realms of ancient history? And remember how disappointing it was that they didn't fuck anybody? Didn't you want to see Mr. Peabody get his hot little doggy holes stuffed by Zebulon Pike or Galileo? Well, now you can. Only instead of a dog and an underage boy, it's two hot sorority chicks using a time machine to screw their way through history. Time Bangers is a hot new series of erotic time travel novels set for full release on July 28th. For more details, check out www.timebangers.com. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll come.
And now back to Skeptically Yours, where thinking is free. We're talking with Geechee Guy, Matt Black, and Simon Singh. Thank you so much for being here, guys.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Nice to be here.
I love running into Geechee and Matt every time we're at TAM. You guys always come hang out with us. Matt, what have you been doing lately? At one point, last time I saw you, were you definitely going to be here for the longevity, or did
you? Yeah, I think that was always kind of the plan, but it was unsure what I was going to be doing. But,
yeah? Yeah. Did you get your green card, or is Trump trying to kick you out?
No, we're good.
All right, good.
It's cool. Yeah, cool. I'm running some VIP events now. I've worked with Jeff Dunham and David Copperfield doing their backstage meet and greets and whatnot.
You work with Copperfield?
I'm working with Copperfield.
Right, I have now. Questions for you.
Okay.
I have stories and questions.
Nice.
Yeah, right? You know I work for Penn & Teller.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got to talk.
All right.
I want to hear some backstage stories.
Cool.
Trick or Treatment is the name of the book. You go after alternative medicine.
Nope.
Tell me what happened.
Oh, jeez.
Tell me about it.
No. I think some people say it's anti-alternative medicine.
Yeah.
And my co-author, Edzard Ernst, who's the world's first professor of complementary medicine, we made the point that we're not anti-alternative medicine. We're just pro-evidence.
Yeah.
And in some cases, alternative therapies kind of work.
See, that's what I want to ask about. I mean, it's we've gone round and round in our community about needles.
What are these
acupuncture.
Cases?
Acupuncture.
That's what we
right?
want to know.
There's studies that come out that say it's slightly better than placebo. And then there's studies that come out and say, no, it's below that or at placebo. And we just kind of keep going round and round on this weird wheel with regard to that one. And the other question I have for you, I'm sorry to load you up here. The other question is, isn't there a positive to placebo? I mean, shouldn't we consider the possibility that it isn't purely negative if indeed there is even a placebo effect?
Yeah. Well, okay. So just before I get too cheerful about alternative medicine, most of the stuff we looked at in the book doesn't work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Reiki, homeopathy. You know, lots of all these alternative therapies just do not work. Some of them are even dangerous. Okay,
yeah.
So in general, the book is negative about alternative therapies, but it's not ideologically anti-alternative. And the ones that do work, things like, you know, if you've got a back problem, the Alexander technique's not too bad. If you've got irritable bowel syndrome, then hypnotherapy is not too bad.
What?
You know, yeah,
right?
There are some of these. Well, these have been proven or demonstrated in. Double-blind
right.
controlled trials.
Huh?
So, you know, it's not all bad.
I'm confused.
Now, acupuncture.
Put her under and make her non-confused. All right, go ahead.
With acupuncture, one interesting thing is how would you ever test it? You know, with homeopathy, people may know homeopathy is a pill which actually has no active ingredient.
Right.
So it's easy to test homeopathy because I give 100 people over here on my left homeopathy, 100 people on my right, I give them a dummy pill, and nobody knows who's got the real pill and the dummy pill, and you can compare the two groups. And when you compare the two groups, they're the same. So a homeopathic pill is essentially just a dummy pill. But when you want to test acupuncture, okay, I give this group on the left, I give them acupuncture because they've got migraine. The group on the right, I want them to think they're getting acupuncture.
How do you do that?
But how do I fake acupuncture? So there are different ways you can do it. One way you can do it is...
Blind test subjects. No, that doesn't work.
You can stick needles in the wrong place. Because
uh-huh.
in traditional Chinese medicine, you have to put it in very specific places.
Yeah.
So you can kind of use it like a dart. You use a person like a dartboard and just put the pins in anywhere. Another thing you can do is put the pins in the right places, but very superficially, so that they're not going to hit these supposed meridians.
Right.
The third thing you can do, which is even better, is you get like stage dagger needles. So they look as though they go into the skin,
right.
But actually the needle goes back up into the little handle.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And you feel some pain, but the skin is not actually punctured.
Yeah.
And then you can compare the two groups.
Yeah.
And when you do this...
There's a problem with that, too. Acupressure is another kind of claim.
Well, we could then
relies on the same bullshit.
Yeah, well, we could then talk about acupressure and so on. And we
right.
could, yeah, you're right. That's a fair point. But when you look at all of the data for acupuncture... For a few conditions, like nausea and pain, there is borderline positive benefit. But it's very, very dodgy. It's very, very borderline. And it's not really clinically significant. It doesn't really help patients in a long-term way that's going to make a sufficient difference for it to be worthwhile. So for me, The borderline positive effect is just within the margins of error of it being just a placebo.
So then it has to be called, if you're being honest, it has to be called a placebo effect best.
Yeah, I can't discount it completely because of the evidence is borderline, but that's the way I would interpret it.
Yeah.
Have either of you had acupuncture before?
Oh, no.
No?
No.
What do you think of it?
I think it's all bullshit. Right?
You've always thought that.
But I've always been ridiculously skeptical.
And Geechee's not. I mean, you're kind of a mystical guy. You smoked pot for a long time.
I did.
Yeah.
You know, just smoking pot doesn't make you mystical.
Well, no, but a lot of times mystical people will smoke a lot of pot.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for supporting my slam on you.
Yeah. Hey, I'm no stranger to slams.
But I think there's also you have to say, well, if acupuncture, and you also said, well, you know, is placebo a bad thing anyway?
That's the other question that I think isn't addressed often.
But I think also with acupuncture, we have to say, if there's no solid benefit, is it harmless? Well, it's not harmless because significant fraction of people have minor bleeding, bruising, temporary pain. There are rare incidences of more serious side effects. So, you know, given that background of risk and harm, you know, I wouldn't recommend anybody try acupuncture.
Well, it can also guide people. It can move people away from known effective options
That's right. And also, it's a gateway into traditional Chinese medicine of a herbal nature. Right. And herbs are dangerous. You know, herbs are, you know, people think, oh, it's natural, it's traditional, it must be safe. But each herb is a complex cocktail of chemicals.
Right.
And if you're on medication already, you know, as many elderly people maybe say, I'll give acupuncture a go, and they're already on a whole series of medications, those herbal medicines will interact.
Yeah.
So, for instance, St. John's wort, and there's some borderline evidence that St. John's wort may help with mild depression, but St. John's wort also accelerates the function of the liver. And so there are some drugs that you may be taking, if you accelerate the function of the liver, that will destroy those drugs that you are taking, and therefore those effective drugs may be neutralized effectively.
Right.
That affects things like some immunosuppressants and the contraceptive pill. So these are effects that people need to be aware of if they're going to dabble with herbal medicine. But coming back to your good point, which I'm not trying to evade, if it's just a placebo, what's the harm in that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and let's take a pure placebo, like homeopathy. There's no side effects, there's no harm, there's no bleeding, there's no bruising with homeopathy. What's wrong with that? If I've got a cold and it makes me feel better, the problem with that is that to get the placebo effect, you've got to lie to me.
Yeah.
You've got to mislead me. You've got to make me think it really works.
Right.
And the more you lie to me, the bigger the placebo effect. So do we want our medical professionals lying to us in order to elicit some kind of response?
Right.
Secondly, the placebo effect is unreliable. It's short term. Thirdly, if we're going to let homeopaths sell us placebos, do we want the big pharmaceutical companies to sell us placebos and lie to us? Well, hell no. If the big pharmaceutical companies do stuff like that, we laugh. We take them to court.
Right.
And it should be an equal playing field across the board. Then I would say that you have to remember that effective drugs come with a placebo effect as well. So if I've got hay fever and I'm just taking a placebo, I feel a bit better.
Yeah.
But if I take an antihistamine, I get a real specific effect plus the placebo on top.
Right.
So just a placebo is shortchanging me. And then there are things like the way I got into this was I heard about young kids going to, after their college, going to Africa and tropical countries and using homeopathy to protect themselves against malaria.
Oh, man.
And mosquitoes don't know about the placebo effect, so it doesn't work for that.
Right.
It's an interesting point, but for me, it just being a placebo is not enough for it to justify being used as a medicine. I think we're past that.
Yeah. Trying to debunk or trying to expose the awfulness of homeopathy has become a little complex. We'll talk about that when we get back from the break. You're listening to Skeptically Yours on SkepticallyYours.net and available at the iTunes Store. More after this insufferable disruption. Have you heard of our other award-winning podcast, Ardent Atheist? Well, you have now, so go check it out. Please go to www.ardentatheist.com. And now again, it's time for a Geech joke.
Two antennas get married. The wedding was okay, but the reception was amazing.
Foundation Beyond Belief is a community of compassionate humanists and atheists supporting outstanding charities worldwide. Members sign up for automatic donations starting at $5 a month, then distribute those funds however they wish among the featured charities. To date, this unique humanist organization has raised over $750,000 to make this world a better, more humane place. We don't look to the skies for a better world. Foundation Beyond Belief is humanity at work. Learn more or join us at foundationbeyondbelief.org.
Hi, I'm David Diskin, and I wanted to tell you about Camp Quest West. We're a secular summer camp for non-religious families, and our week-long program for kids runs this summer in locations in California and over a dozen others throughout the U.S. At Camp Quest, we give kids the traditional camp experience, like archery, swimming, arts and crafts, and campfire songs. But we add science, skepticism, humanism, and critical thinking. There's a few spots left for parents who want to register their kids, but we're also asking for your help. We turn every donation into camperships for families that can't afford to send their children to camp. We're 100% volunteer-based, a tax-exempt 501c3, and our amazing financial aid program is supported by the free thought and skeptic community by people like you. I want to see how much Emery and Heather's fans can raise for Camp Quest West. Visit tinyurl.com/ardentcampquest or look for the link on their Facebook page. You can learn more about our California camps and the others throughout the U.S. by visiting campquest.org.
Hey, kids, remember the good old days of simple, wholesome fun? Back when you could watch cartoons on Saturday morning? Remember watching Mr. Peabody and Sherman use their Wayback Machine to visit the realms of ancient history? And remember how disappointing it was that they didn't fuck anybody? Didn't you want to see Mr. Peabody get his hot little doggy holes stuffed by Zebulon Pike or Galileo? Well, now you can. Only instead of a dog and an underage boy, it's two hot sorority chicks using a time machine to screw their way through history. Time Bangers is a hot new series of erotic time travel novels set for full release on July 28th. For more details, check out www.timebangers.com. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll come.
Back to Skeptically Yours, where thinking is free. We're talking with Geechee Guy, Matt Black, and Simon Singh. Thank you for being here, guys. I actually went and found this number file episode that we were talking about earlier. I'm wondering if we can... It's a six-minute thing. I don't think we have to play the whole thing. We can get the basic argument pretty quickly, probably.
Maths.
What's going on here?
So you're me in your math class.
Science without maths.
Emotions run high about maths versus math. If you're an American living in Britain, you will have... been corrected a lot and told things like, you know, what's wrong with you Americans? Don't you realize that there's an S on the end of mathematics, so you need an S on the end of math?
You are an American living in Britain.
I am an American living in Britain.
Tell me about how much problem this causes you.
Well, I mean, it's enough that I now say maths because I don't want to have an argument.
Math,
well, it's only in the 19th
maths.
Century that people started abbreviating mathematics. And at that point, the first known use of math is from 1847. That's what the Oxford English Dictionary has recorded. There, you know, people are using it with a full stop, or a period, as we Americans say. And there's not a lot of evidence there that people were actually saying it. It looks like it started out as an abbreviation in writing and not an abbreviation in speech. So that's going, you know, that starts around 1847. It's not till 1911... that we see maths with an S. And again, it looks like people weren't probably saying it then. They were probably just writing it, you know, in course catalogs or things like that. English people will say to me, there's an S on the end of mathematics, so you need to put the S on the end of maths, which, you know, I counter, but we don't put the last letter from other abbreviations onto the end of those abbreviations. So when you say fax instead of facsimile, you don't say faxy. Just because there's an E on the end of
fax. See, I didn't buy
that. So that argument that you should put the last letter on to an abbreviation, I don't quite understand, except that a lot of people say this because they believe that mathematics is plural. And so you have to use the S to mark the plural in mathematics on maths. The problem with that is that mathematics isn't plural. You don't say, there are two mathematics that I need to look at. And when you make maths or mathematics agree with a verb, you make it agree with a singular verb, not a plural one. So you don't say mathematics are interesting. You say maths is interesting. So you use, you know, there's plenty of linguistic evidence that that's a singular. But people see the S and think, if there's an S on the end of a noun, it must be plural.
Does that mean Americans have this deeper understanding of what constitutes plural?
Au contraire, my friend.
No, I don't think so. I think it's that, and I don't think necessarily that British people put the S on the end because they did think it was plural. It was the habit that was got into, probably because it was first a written form. And
my favorite thing about this entire video is right over her right shoulder is a book called Semantics. That's not an accident. That was put there. Are you convinced by those points? Because she'd made one compelling, and that is that she's arguing that it isn't plural, which was where I was thinking.
Yeah, I think she's nailed it. That it's a habit taken on from the abbreviation in the written form, and I can see that's where it's come from. And then if you want to justify it, you justify it by thinking that maths is plural when it clearly isn't, because mathematics is interesting.
Yeah.
Mathematics are interesting. Don't make no sense.
It's funny you say that, because when I came across that part, I thought, I think they're interchangeable. But that's because I was in the headspace of trying to find support for, and we all do this, by the way, find support for the maths argument as opposed to the other. And I had been in that headspace for months at this point when this thing rolled out and I saw it months ago.
Why are they wasting so much time figuring out what to call it when there's so many maths problems that aren't solved yet? Why don't they... I'm just saying, go and figure out all the problems and figure out what to call them after you're finished.
I think that's really good advice, Geech. Thanks.
You fixed the whole thing.
Yeah.
Oh, Geechee, there you go. Okay.
Geechee brings it down to its finest point. So, it is all semantics. It drives me nuts. I'm convinced that we allow words to be added to our dictionary like za and changing... Waza. I don't think that's in the dictionary.
No.
But changing the meaning of literally to actually mean figuratively, literally ruining it... figuratively speaking.
I've become more relaxed about all those. There was a wonderful talk online by a woman who is the editor of maybe Funk and Wagnall. Is that a U.S. dictionary?
We use that kind of language here.
She said that in the past, if you were a dictionary editor, you know, a dictionary was only so big. So part of your job was to keep the bad words out because we didn't have space enough. We didn't have enough space for the bad words. So
not bad, dirty, but like crappy words.
Yeah,
like waste of time.
That's right. So like an editor was a defender of the dictionary. But now you have an online dictionary. It's more like a fisherman going out and just trawling for new words, because you can put as many words online as you want because the dictionary becomes infinite. So let's get as much in as possible. And if words change their meaning and have alternative meanings, let's get them in as well. So I thought that was a very interesting change from dictionaries of old.
I have a joke about that. I say I was looking through the dictionary and I noticed that everything starts with an E.
Yeah, good one. I like
everything.
Everything. I
starts
get it.
With an E.
I got it. Okay. It took me a minute to get there.
Yeah, it takes you a minute. Well, at least you didn't boo. Most people they'll get it and then boo. And I go, you can't wait till I explain it before you then boo.
Yeah, no, you got to boo as soon as if you can't figure it out.
Now that I get it, you suck.
Fuck
really.
You. Yeah. I'll boo you back for not being able to get it quick enough.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Geechee does a pretty confrontational show.
I'm right in their face. But I do a lot of wordplay and a lot of, you know, so...
Always have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing wordplay.
Actually, I had a one-man show called A Play on Words.
Yeah.
Which, silly.
Another word that it's funny, you know, we talked on the last show about how Heather, when she was in school, she's of mixed race, and when she was in school, someone called her a zebra, and initially she wasn't offended because she didn't understand it. She went home, and Mom was like, that's offensive, and she taught her to be offended by this word. Until a friend of mine pointed out that momentarily is forever being butchered and used improperly, I went through life pretty happy. But now, everywhere I go, people misuse the phrase momentarily.
And then I spoke to someone who was like, no, he's wrong.
Yeah, someone else argued that momentarily.
And then they looked it up in the dictionary and they're like, see, it means this other thing too.
And we're talking about Teller, who was a Latin teacher. And so, you know, he's talking old school. And I think that they let the... I, I think one of the elements of changing the meaning of words as they do is really just to make old guys grumpy.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Like a sense of humor has come to known as funny, but it just means to be able to sense humor. When I come up with a joke, I can sense that everybody else is going to think that's funny.
Right.
It's not about being funny. It's about sensing humor.
I thought it was about a sixth sense.
Okay.
We have numerous senses, don't we?
All right.
Like more than five.
I've got...
It's dozens.
Yeah.
Dozens. Have you heard about this?
Biology is an area where I stay out of biology.
So the code book, cryptology, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, for example, in the code book, I thought, oh, great, I'll have a whole chapter about the genetic code.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I got scared. And
you panicked?
Wrote it.
Really?
Biology just scared.
But you
me.
Know people. You could have done that.
Yeah, but maths and physics is my comfort zone, so I just stick with that.
Pussy. Come on. Now I want you to do it. I want you to do the genetic code.
No. When I used to work in TV, I used to come across these incredible stories about cryptography.
Yeah.
New ideas that were going to change the world, and they have done, but they weren't televisual, so they never ever got turned into TV items. But I had this giant folder, so when I became a writer, I just thought, this is a great story. You know, it's a huge amount of mathematics,
yeah,
but it's also about spies and villains,
encryption stuff,
and life and death and wars and battles. So it's kind of maths changing history.
Yeah. Yeah, have you gotten into the work of decryption and figuring out those codes?
I don't have the dedication or the brain to crack codes, but
so you're not good at Minesweeper?
No.
Do you know that game?
I used to be, yeah.
Such
and
an
I used
old
to play
game.
It. I love, yeah, and you're right. That is a kind of a code breaking game. But I just went back to the very beginning. You know, when people started to write stuff down,
yeah,
they wanted to hide it. Yeah. So you have examples of a pottery glaze. Being documented in cuneiform, but it's in an encrypted form of cuneiform. You have examples, with the rise of the Arabic civilization and the golden age of the Arabic civilization and huge commerce and inventions and so on. Again, encryption was incredibly important. And the oldest known document we have on code breaking comes from Baghdad. A guy called Al-Kindi worked out that every letter's got a certain frequency. So if you substitute every letter with a symbol, well, if you have lots of diamond shapes, well, the diamond shape's got to be an E, because E is the most common letter in English. So he did the same thing with Arabic and was able to crack codes and so on. And then I would go through the Elizabethan era and the Victorian telegraph era and the First World War and the Second World War and the Enigma, and then right up to where we are today, whereby every device in this room, every part of our lives is dominated by encryption, whether it's medical data being encrypted or whether it's our phone communications.
The orgasm.
I don't think they encrypt the orgasm, honey. No, it's not.
No, that was another.
How come so many people don't know where to find it?
Well, that's you got to talk to your guys.
I'm talking to you.
Okay, I'm here. Simon, can you help me find the orgasm?
I've gone very shy now.
He already said biology isn't his thing.
Yeah, he did. Here's a thing that always I always wonder about when we see ancient things decrypted, and not just like you're talking about literal encryption. You know, I mean, how do we know we've got it right? There was a book a long time ago.
Yeah.
Maybe 15, 20 years ago, I saw a book, a pretty quick book, a big book, almost made for kids, and it was about this explorer that found this ancient ruin, and they dug it all out, and as you turn the book, turn the pages, you realize they found a motel somewhere, like an old motel in the middle of the desert, you know. And it has a toilet, and it's got the room, and it's got multiple rooms, and it's got the office. And they had explanations. It's a comedic piece. And they had explanations for each of these things, all of them connected to worship and silliness and stuff like that. And it's that book that always rings in my head when I hear about, we've figured out or we've cracked or we understand now what they were doing. Do we really?
Well, I mean, I did.
There's a risk, right?
I did write a couple of chapters about the decipherment of ancient languages. Because that is just like a process of code breaking. Those languages weren't written to confuse people, but they confuse us now, so we have to apply the same principles of code breaking to get into them. And And there are examples where people delude themselves and say, we've cracked this code and we now understand linear A or some other ancient manuscript or ancient script. And somebody said, a really good way to test whether or not you've broken it or not is if you've got tons and tons of gods, names of gods in your decipherment, then you've probably got it wrong. Because basically everywhere the decipherment doesn't work, people say, that must be the name of a god. So if you've got
They're actually godding the gaps.
Yeah. That's very, very good. But if you there's a lovely example, linear B and hieroglyphics and cuneiform and the Mayan glyphs. It's pretty clear once you begin to crack it, once you begin to get words, it just falls out in
it
front of you.
It kind of falls together.
It just naturally runs away. It's no longer hard labor to decipher words.
Yeah.
The scripts just make sense. So, for example, linear B was a Minoan script that was found probably in the early 1900s.
Right.
And it was found by an English archaeologist who was desperate. He said, he'd uncovered Minoa and he'd uncovered Knossos and he'd uncovered these wonderful ruins, and he so much wanted it to be its own civilization, not part of the Greek civilization, but its own independent empire with its own script and its own language and everything. So everybody tried to decipher this script in light of some new language that they'd never before thought about, and everybody failed because it turned out that this was actually just Greek.
Yeah.
It was an ancient form of Greek, more ancient than anything anybody had ever deciphered before. But once you appreciated it was Greek, then the script just cracked.
Right.
And suddenly you could read these tallies of... And what was interesting was that the stuff they discovered was kind of boring. It was just shopping lists. But once you know what people are buying, once you know what their shopping lists are, then you know how they live.
It says a lot about them, yeah.
It was an important part of giving a sense of their day-to-day lives and how they trade and so on.
Yeah. Are we going to be a society one day that has to be decrypted? Is that probable? It seems like we're pretty fucking entrenched and there's a lot of us around. But I suspect everyone thinks that throughout their lives.
I'm just trying to think when these things... We I think you go through dark ages, and when you go through dark ages, information gets lost, and then you break that bridge.
Yeah.
And then you have to rediscover
it. Like ISIS trying to just burn away everything.
Yeah. Hoping that we don't ever go through another dark age.
Right.
And there's a continuity, we should be all right. But
right.
But with, Minoan linear B, civilization died, it was forgotten, it was maybe, as you say, destroyed by the next civilization. They just didn't want to acknowledge it. And so maybe it was deliberately buried. And palaces were burned. That was an important point because this writing was on clay tablets, and clay tablets crumble to dust.
Sure.
But because the palaces were burned, then the clay tablets were cooked.
Preserved.
And when they were cooked, they were preserved.
Yeah.
So, because ideally you want to keep them as clay so you can wet them, erase them, and write on them again.
Right.
But by setting fire and trying to destroy the civilization, in fact, they'd save
it. They preserved it. Mm. Wow. Well, we're doing a lot of things to try to prevent that from happening. We're shooting probes into space.
Yeah.
I wonder if we shouldn't endeavor to put as much information as we can, and that's the hardest part. How do you make it so it's easy to decrypt if it needs to be decrypted? On the other planets, I think that's one of the answers in terms of making sure that would be the best way we could leave pyramids behind if we did get wiped off the face of the earth by whatever it might be. Is that considered in the scientific community? I've never heard of that.
I think whenever people build these time capsules, either here on Earth or sending them out into space into these probes that now go beyond the solar system, there is thought given to how do you draw a map that some alien species will be able to interpret and figure out where we are.
One of the most amazing things I ever heard from somebody was when it was explained to me that if we crack the code of the dolphins, and we find out they do high communicate. They do have massive understanding of things, ideas, concepts, and even abstract. And we start communicating with them. We got another couple thousand years before we can actually communicate with them. Do you know what I'm talking about when I say this?
Okay.
Because perspectives are so dramatically different.
Like feels like biology, that's all.
It's really not. It's communication.
Yeah, okay.
And to communicate with another species, yeah. I always wonder what's going to be the next species that evolves. It seems illogical that something else wouldn't eventually evolve as we did to be self-aware. What's the next thing? What one day are we going to walk out front and it's going to go, hey, man, cut it out. You know what I mean? It seems dolphins are a good chance of that. But to communicate with them would be near impossible, even if we understood every word they were saying. Do you know what I mean? Even if we had a direct translation. And this is a problem. I know this is a problem when you decrypt ancient civilizations. Trying to understand them is really difficult, and they're the same goddamn species.
Yeah, yeah. And unless before they deciphered hieroglyphs, archaeologists and Egyptologists made up their own stories. They made up, it was entirely wishful thinking.
Yeah.
And then I think it was Champollion who went along and. Began to what he was able to do was he was able to look at some of the names of the more modern pharaohs, which were Greek names, and because they were Greek names, they were spelt out phonetically, and so you could begin to grasp what the symbols were that spelt out Cleopatra, because that had to be spelt out. It wasn't an ancient Greek name,
right.
Or Ptolemy. Again, it's not an ancient Greek name, so it had to be spelt ancient Egyptian name, so it had to be spelt out. And then once you could crack hieroglyphs. And read what it was that the Egyptians were worshipping and trading and so on, then you understood what Egyptian history was all about.
Right. We only recently discovered they didn't use slaves, right? Do you know about that?
I didn't.
The latest. Yeah, you know how this goes, right? The latest in the ether is that they didn't have slaves. They've
build the pyramids.
Right,
he's referring to.
Right. Yeah, to get the pyramids built. It appears that these were honorable people that were treated very well that were working on these pyramids, which I'm like, that doesn't prove they're not slaves. You could treat slaves well, I guess.
They did, however, use slaves to build the pyramid here in Vegas.
They did? Were they Mexicans?
I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Matt.
Yes, sir.
Last time we had you on the show... Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm well.
Are you waking up?
I'm good.
Come into the mic.
Oh, come in. Okay, that's really not cool.
you were saying during the break you were talking to Simon about where you grew up. What part of London, rather, what part of England are you from?
I was born in the north of England in Newcastle, where the brown ale is from.
Uh-huh.
And then my parents...
It's offensive, you know.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, you can't say brown ale
anymore.
African American ale.
Right. Yeah. No, it's African American ale.
It's absurd. It's fucking absurd.
There is an Indian pale ale, isn't there?
There is an Indian pale ale.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
Which I think comes in was in a nice brown bottle in order to stop it going off, and as it was shipped off around the empire, I think. But anyway. My knowledge of beer history is not great.
Yeah, no, I'm not big on the booze history myself. But then I grew up in the south of England, just outside of London.
Yeah. Why did you come to the U.S.?
I came
on... And it always blows me away when a Brit or an Aussie makes their way from those lovely countries to this shithole.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't really doing much back home. I had a bit of time to kill, and a buddy of mine lived out here.
Yeah.
And he was like, come over. Come and stay with me. So I did. And that I met my wife about a month into my trip, and
that's how it always works.
We got married, and I've been here ever since. I've not been home. I've not left this place.
Yeah,
that's why Brian Setzer lives in Minneapolis, and that's why Peter Frampton lives in Cincinnati, because they found someone there that will fuck them.
It's true.
It's all about the sex, isn't it?
It's pretty much all about that sex.
Okay, you're making Simon nervous. This is biology you're talking.
Yeah, it's okay.
All right. I want to make sure we touch on Big Bang, too.
Show?
Well, actually, yes, absolutely. Simon wrote a book, Big Bang.
I have a link with the show.
Yeah.
which is that when the band
I work on the show. I work for Chuck Lorre.
Ah, okay. Well,
so we both have a link.
I better stop making stuff up then.
No. Go ahead.
No, when the Bare Naked Ladies were asked to write the theme.
Yeah.
Ed Roberts had just read my book.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, yeah, well, you know, they've been asked to do a few theme tunes in the past and kind of got a bit jaded by it all. But because he just read the book and because he was just asked, he kind of used the book as a bit of an inspiration to write the theme tune. So that's my link with the Big Bang Theory.
I didn't know that story. I started out with that band in Canada. We were doing NACACON.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. Well,
really?
Well, when I started...
You were opening for them?
No, we were doing colleges. Around 1991, you would go. A bunch of college acts would go to a conference, and 50 colleges would come to book their acts, and they were at the same conference as I was, and they were making $1,000 a show back then.
Right.
And now they make a lot more.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was 1991.
Are they still touring? They loved them for so fucking long. Saturday night.
They were
Are you kidding me?
At the Cosmopolitan with the Violent Femmes and Colin Hay.
Yeah.
God damn it. And you're in production too, right, Simon? I mean, over in Britain, you've produced many shows.
I used to. It was a long time ago, a long time ago. I made a documentary about Fermat's Last Theorem with a colleague called John Lynch. And so I've made the hour-long documentaries, and I've made half-hour TV magazine shows, and I've presented a few things on radio and TV. But now I tend to focus more on writing.
Yeah.
It's more my thing.
You should come to Hollywood and make more shows. We need more science-minded producers.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think we live in a pretty lucky time. There's more science around, I think, than there has been for maybe 20, 30, 40 years.
Well, it's almost hip now.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the 70s when there were some great TV shows, and we were landing on the moon, and we had people like Magnus Pike and James Burke, who then came and made big over here. And then science kind of went off the radar for a while. But now there's great stuff online. We would talk about.
We call that the Dark Ages of Benny Hill.
we were talking about Numberphile earlier on, and Numberphile gets a million hits for maths videos.
Yeah,
there's a woman called Vi Hart who makes the most beautiful, charming, witty mathematical videos. Again, she doesn't make so many, but when she does, she gets a million hits.
I'm surprised it's only a million. Honestly, I mean, there's 300 million people in the U.S. Most of them are wired in. Half of them are younger. Mm. I'm really surprised by these kinds of numbers.
My colleague of mine, whose name? Richard Wiseman.
Yeah.
Who's a psychologist and made various TV shows. And you make a TV show in England, and you get 1 million, 2 million people watching. That's pretty big.
That's considered a huge number.
That's a big number.
30 million used to be a big hit when I was a kid, when you were a kid.
Yeah, but now he makes YouTube videos about psychology and something he calls quirkology, and he's had about 100 million hits.
Yeah, he's brilliant. That guy. Have you seen his videos?
I don't know that I have. I might have, but I don't remember.
He has wonderful stuff.
There's stuff that he's been desperate to try and get on TV that TV people just don't quite get. But he puts it online. Everybody else gets it. 100 million views. It's fantastic.
Yeah, that's an impressive number, and I'm really surprised that we don't see all of the skeptic science stuff getting multi hundreds of millions, not hundreds, but millions and millions, like 30, 40 million. Mm-hmm. That should be our goal, I think.
With Numberphile, I would confidently say Numberphile videos have had over 100 million views in total.
Yeah, when you add them up.
But that's still phenomenal for a really... I mean, some of the stuff they do is technically pretty highbrow.
Yeah.
And you would never get any of it near a national TV station.
No. It's digestible, but it's not cut down. It doesn't have its legs cut out, which I think is perfect what they do. 6 to 10 minutes probably is what they do.
Yeah, no, Brady Haran... is one of the most successful video producers in the world now, I'd imagine. The stuff he creates is fantastic. And he's also done it for chemistry, and he's done it for physics. There's another website called The Periodic Table. What's clever is that, he did all the elements of The Periodic
Table. Oh, he makes The Periodic Table with the old guy with the hair?
That's it.
I can't stop watching those.
Martin Polyakov.
Is that who he is? Okay.
Who is Stephen Polyakov's brother, who is the film producer.
Right.
Film director. So it's interesting that this chemistry professor has the media bug through his brother, maybe. But he looks like Einstein. He's
yeah, he's great.
But once they did the whole periodic table,
Step by step through every single element.
And then you run out of elements, and then they would do things like, the royal prince has just got engaged, and what's the engagement ring made of? It's made of a sapphire. Let's make a video about the chemistry of sapphires.
Yeah.
So they get nice hooks and interesting ways into different bits of chemistry.
It's a crazy good show.
Yeah. And stuff gets blown up as well. I mean, there's lots.
They definitely use the MythBusters hook, if you will, when they can. It's a fantastic show. I love falling down that rabbit hole. I'll spend an entire night just consuming more and more and more of them. Every couple months, I fall into it. Done with the free portion of the show. Did you have something to add?
Nope.
All right, we only have 30 minutes left, but ladies and gentlemen, that is it for the free version of episode 97 of the show that went off without a hitch.
We miss you, Hitch.
We'll be making the full 90 minutes available to our premium subscribers very soon. If you'd like to hear the full 90-minute show, please go to skepticalyours.net/premium and subscribe. I want to thank our guests, Geechee Guy, Matt Black, and Simon Singh. I also want to thank my co-host, Heather Henderson, and our producer, Heather Henderson, and our camera switcher, Ryan Magnan. Tune in next week when our guests will be...
L.A. folk.
We will be back in Los Angeles, folks. And we'll be talking about...
How much we miss Tam.
Yeah, we got to decompress when we leave here.
Our theme music courtesy of the sound editor of The Aristocrats, Eric Wilson, and special thanks to our Wall of Reason moderator, Joseph, we love you, Swam, and our digital publicist and web guru, Cameron, hey, fuck you, Winters.
You got tired of writing, didn't you? Where can people find you, Simon?
Oh, sorry. SimonSing.net, and on Twitter, I'm SLSing.
SimonSing.net, SINGH.
That's it, you got it.
And SLC?
SLSing, SLSING.
SINGH. You've heard that 100 times, haven't you? You've never heard that? SING. And Matt, where can people find you?
On the Twitter, the Matt Black, MattBlack. Also the Periscope. I've been Periscoping.
Oh, nice.
It's fun. We do it too. Yeah, Geechee, where do they find you?
Oh, I'm on Twitter, but I don't do it much. Facebook.
Yeah. And check him out. I Geechee Guy everywhere.
Over to Ron White, and I do a lot of cruises. So just look out for me if you're out.
I want to hear stories about Ron White in the premium version of the show.
Okay.
You've been listening to Skeptically Yours on SkepticallyYours.net. I'm your host, Emery.
And I'm Heather Henderson.
And we are Skeptically Yours. Skeptically Yours is a product of a never-expanding universe.